for coming to another in our series on legal ethics. This one is Professional Confidentiality and the Demands of Jewish Law. We are approved for 1.5 hours of professionalism credit from the Law Society. I should note that that means I'm likely to use 1.5 hours. A couple of things. First of all, from a Jewish law perspective, nothing I say should be taken as psak, as a ruling in halacha. I'm trying to discuss the aspects of Jewish ethics and Jewish law that relate to this, but fundamentally I believe that one should consult one's own rabbinic authority for practical decisions. Ditto from the legal side. Those who have been here before know I am not a lawyer. I don't pretend to be one. I am working from the sources that you'll see on the sheets regarding legal issues, but please do not take this as legal advice. And in the event that you have a particular confidentiality issue that requires professional opinion, please seek a professional opinion. But please make sure that you sign in. There are 3 sign-in sheets. One of them ended up here. One of them is over there. Does anyone know where the third one is? Third one is down there. Please make sure that you sign in. Don't bring it up. Let it stay there, please. Yeah, thank you. But please make sure that you sign in, particularly if you want credit. If you email me afterwards saying I was there, that doesn't really work. I now have the benefit of Elaine taking a couple of pictures, and maybe we could verify you were here, but it's better if you just sign in on the sheet. That confirms your attendance. Thank you. Last, I imagine someone here may have a cell phone. If you could please silence your phone, that would be appreciated. So, this is actually an updated version of a class I gave, 5 years ago or so at Shari Shamayim on professional confidentiality. I'm going to get the words right. Professional confidentiality. I say it's updated because I've gained a little more sophistication in the years since, and people have asked me questions that have informed my own understanding of the topic. What I'd like to do is talk about the basis for confidentiality as a value in the law society and in secular society. Well, not the law society, sorry. First, confidentiality in general society and confidentiality in Judaism in general. Then to talk about how that applies to a lawyer, specific issues that relate to the practice of law. And then to move from that to a discussion of the exceptions to the rule, the ones that make things fun, the questions that come up. So when do you break confidentiality? And then finally to deal with 3 questions which you have on your sheet further down, 3 particular cases. One, we'll talk about them when we get up to them, but one of them involving the question of breaking confidentiality to avoid financial harm to a particular party. Second, question of disclosing confidential information for one's own protection as a lawyer. And then third, the big question for many people is, so what if the law society says I cannot disclose? However, Jewish law seems to say that I should disclose. Now, what does Judaism expect of me? So those are the 3 questions that I'm looking to that I'm looking to deal with after all of the preface. As always, please interrupt me in the middle. Do not wait to the end for questions, because we will use all the time otherwise. If I feel like I need to move on, I'll let you know. So the general principle of confidentiality in society, Canadian society, is protected by federal law. Right? Section 8 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms protects us from search and seizure, which unreasonably invades privacy. You have the Privacy Act of 1983 that limited what the government could do with personal data. You have another act, which I never remember how to pronounce correctly, but I'm going to go with PIPEDA. Is that right? PIPEDA, thank you, in 2008, that limits commercial use of personal data. You have the tort, which I noted in source number 1 on the sheet, intrusion upon seclusion. With the recent recognition of the new tort, this was article was 2012, with the recent recognition of the new tort of intrusion upon seclusion, Canadian privacy law has experienced a fundamental and modernizing shift. And he talks about a case here in which the Ontario Court of Appeal held that a person is liable for an invasion of privacy if, quote, he or she intrudes physically or otherwise upon the seclusion of another or his private affairs or concerns, if the invasion would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. Right, so of course you have to assess what highly offensive means, and more important, you have to assess what reasonable means. But this already tells us that a person is responsible to make sure not to invade the privacy of others. People want their privacy, and it's actionable in court if someone does invade the privacy of others. Interestingly, this tort existed in the U.S. for over a century before it made it here, but now it's in Canada as well. From a Jewish perspective, we also have a value of privacy. It's generally understood as a matter of protecting other people. And we have it regarding physical privacy, and we have it regarding information privacy as well. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 2, I bring you an example of this regarding physical invasion of privacy. It relates to a law that's called in Judaism Hezek Re'iyah, which means, literally, damage via sight, by seeing someone else's property. The way the rule works essentially is, I am not allowed to look into somebody else's domain, somebody else's property. I am walking past their house on the street, and their bay window is wide open, and there are no shades. I'm not allowed to intentionally look inside. Obviously, if I see something as I'm walking down the street, that's not what we're talking about. But I'm not allowed to specifically try to look into their house. I'm not allowed to look into their backyard. Now, you could argue the bay window case, because there, they put something on display for everybody, whatever it is that's going on. They know they don't have shades up. So there's an argument to be made in that case. But certainly when it comes to something that's going on in their backyard, I am not allowed to look in. I'm not allowed to build onto my house in a way which would enable me to look in either. So if you take a look at source number 2, Rabbi Yehoshua Falk, in his work Sefer Miradei Inayim V'Sma, Commentary to the Code of Jewish Law, explains why I am not allowed to look into this person's yard. And in general, in the sources, I've brought the Hebrew along with the English for the sake of authenticity, and so that those who have the Hebrew will be able to read it. But I'm going to read out only the English aloud in the interests of time. And Rabbi Falk comments on the protection that's extended in the Code of Jewish Law, and really based on the Talmud, for people's privacy. And he says, what's the issue of not looking into somebody else's property? So he says, in 154 section 3, in the Code of Jewish Law, sight of the property itself does not harm. It's not that looking into somebody's field or looking into somebody's yard, in the case that he's citing, is considered damaging in and of itself. But it causes harm, as the other person cannot go about his business in his yard due to embarrassment. In other words, there's an issue of affecting the way he's going to use his own property. He feels like he can't walk into his backyard and do what he wants to do because somebody else can see in. So there's an issue of invasion of privacy in the sense that it damages his use of his own property. Separate from that, though, there's the issue of intellectual privacy, privacy of information. Take a look, please, at source number 3. This is a passage from the book of Vayikra of Leviticus, and it says, do not travel as a peddler, meaning a peddler of tales, in your nation. Do not stand by the blood of your neighbor. We'll come back to that one a little bit later. I am Hashem. I am God. God warns, you're not allowed to peddle tales to other people. You're not allowed to talk about the affairs of others. That's a basic rule in Judaism. It is called in Hebrew rechilut or rechilus, and it prohibits me from informing people of information about others. It's very important to understand, for those who have some familiarity with the Jewish law elements of this, this is different from the rule of Lashon Hara, or Motzi Shem Ra. We have many laws in Judaism restricting people's speech. Free speech and Judaism are a challenge. We have a rule against Motzi Shem Ra. Motzi Shem Ra means I am not allowed to give somebody a bad reputation by saying things that are untrue about them. Right? Most basic. I'm not allowed to go around saying things about somebody else that are not true and will give them a bad reputation. That's ground floor. Then you have the prohibition against Lashon Hara, which is that I am not allowed to speak negatively of others, even if it's true. Even if it's 100% true, I'm still not allowed to go around saying bad things about other people. And then the highest level here, the one we're invoking now, is the rule of privacy, rechilut, tale-bearing, which says that even where the information is true, and even where it's not negative, I'm still not allowed to go around informing people of it. I'm not allowed to spread the news. Now, there are exceptions to the rule, right? Where information is clearly intended to be public, and particularly where there's a benefit to the person, then I am allowed to disclose. So let's say, God forbid, but it happens, somebody loses a parent. And the funeral is going to be later that day, right? So I find out that that happened. I am allowed to inform other people that they're going to go to the funeral. We're not going to expect that the bereaved person now has to inform everybody directly. That's ridiculous. We don't do that. It's understood that it's intended to be public information. But the default assumption is that information is private, and that I'm not allowed to share it with others. We get a hint of this as well in the passage in source number 4, a passage from the Talmud. It comments on a verse in which God calls out to Moshe, to Moses, and it says he spoke to Moses from the tent of meeting, from the Ohel Moed, Lemur, and that's understood here to mean to go tell others. God says to Moses, here's the following information, now go tell it to other people. And on this, the Talmud deduces, how do we know that one may not repeat something told to him until he is told, go tell it? How do you know I am not allowed to go tell somebody something that I was told unless they explicitly say, go tell it to others? And we quote the verse, and God spoke to him from the tent of meeting to go tell. He told him, go inform other people, and therefore we understand he's supposed to disclose it. But otherwise, we don't do so. And the most basic reason for that is the protection of society. If you take a look at source number 5, from the classic work Sefer HaChinuch, which documents all of the Torah's biblical commandments and tries to provide a little bit of a discussion of each of them. So in mitzvah number 236, he says, regarding this practice of not disclosing information, among the roots of this command is that God desires the good of his creations. And he instructed us in this so that there should be peace among us, as gossip is cause for quarreling and strife. It's good for society if people don't go around sharing the business of others. You'll say we'll get bored and we have nothing to talk about. You can talk all about LeBron beating the Cavaliers, beating the Raptors last night. That's not Lashon Hara, it's not Motzi Shemra, it's not even Rechilus. Everybody knows about it anyway. You can talk about sports. You can do what everybody in Toronto loves to do, and you can talk about the weather. There are all sorts of things that we can talk about that don't involve disclosing information about the affairs of others. So far what we're seeing is there's a value in society in general of privacy, and saying that you should not disclose the information of others. You shouldn't invade the privacy of others, and you should not disclose it to others. You can't use people's data in certain ways. And we have it within Judaism as well. There is one interesting difference, though, that I want to note, which is that when you're dealing with it from a Jewish perspective, there's a religious dimension as well. Privacy is understood as a core element of an individual's relationship with God. If you take a look at source number 6, this is from the prophet Micha. He, God, has told you, man, what is good. In other words, God is informing humanity what human beings should pursue. What should a person's life be built around? What does God require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk privately, hatznei alechet in the Hebrew, to walk privately with your God. Those are the three things, so much so that the Talmud at the end of the volume called Makos discusses how you can digest all of the Torah's mitzvot into certain principles, and at one point it suggests you could actually boil down the entire Torah to these three elements. That doesn't mean that a person can say, great, I love justice, I practice kindness, and I am private, and therefore I don't need to do anything else. It doesn't quite work that way. But these are the pillars of what the Torah wants to teach us. Yeah? Well, keep in mind that it's addressing... No, that's fine. It's addressing a Jewish audience and kind of assuming that your God is the God of the author. of the prophet. But what it's trying to suggest here is that pursuing a private life is considered meritorious. And from this we get the value in Judaism of tzniut. And for a person to be tzanua, for a person to be private, is not simply about the way one dresses, which is often the colloquial use of the term tzniut, but it's about the way one acts. It's about the way one discloses information about one's life, and therefore I shouldn't go around violating the tzniut of others, violating the privacy of others. If it's important for them to be private and I have information about them, then how can I go sharing that? So that's an interesting element in which Judaism adds, aside from the social benefits, which we listed in number 5, of promoting healthy society, there's also the fact that it will promote a strong religious element as well. So this is in terms of general privacy. But now let's get to the practice of law and the issue of confidentiality. So if you take a look at source number 7, you find from the Law Society's Rules of Professional Conduct. I haven't gotten used to writing Law Society of Ontario yet. I still keep writing Law Society of Upper Canada. That's a mistake. It should say Law Society of Ontario. I apologize. Okay. I will make a note on my handout sheet, and that way I will remember in the future. Sorry? There is a rebellion, so maybe I shouldn't change it yet.
There's a time period, though, which you can...
Yeah? Okay.
You can go both ways.
Okay, well, that's what I'm going to end up doing. Okay, so source number 7. A lawyer at all times shall hold in strict confidence all information concerning the business and affairs of the client acquired in the course of the professional relationship, and shall not divulge any such information. All information concerning the business and affairs of the client that one acquires in the course of the professional relationship. So it's information acquired functioning as the person's lawyer. Separate discussion, what if he's also my neighbor and I acquire information because he talks to me, you know, just over the fence. Right? We have the fence, so I don't look into his yard, but he himself comes over and has a conversation with me. But that's the idea, that you have to keep this information confidential, and the rationale for it is fairly straightforward. Right? What's the rationale? Why do we want to make sure that aside from society's general value of confidentiality, why is it important that the lawyer will keep the client's information confidential? I'm monologuing for 15 minutes. You got to help me here. Why is it important that the lawyer keep this information confidential? Important to the relationship? Well, I'm talking about the lawyer not divulging the client's information.
Yeah, but I'm saying the client puts the client at a disadvantage to the lawyer.
You put the client at a disadvantage. That's one possibility, but stronger. Why is confidentiality important? Even where I know it's not going to harm anything. Even if I can say that.
Trust.
Right. It's the issue of trust, and in general, the whole system of legal representation. Right? In the event that clients know that their information may end up somewhere on the street, it could end up on someone's blog, it could end up in an email, it could end up wherever, they're not going to give information to the lawyer. Right? That's what's going to happen. So even if the lawyer receives information which the lawyer believes would be valuable for someone else to know, or even valuable for the public to know, barring certain circumstances, the lawyer is not allowed to divulge it. We're going to talk about the exceptions to the rule, but fundamentally what we're saying is, in order to enable a functional judicial system, including legal representation in which clients are able to trust that that which they say remains between them and the lawyer, we are willing to allow for the harm of those who don't learn information that could have helped them. That's the idea. We are willing to accept the harm to the individual who remains ignorant, in order to benefit society as a whole. Now, this is not only about the lawyer. It isn't only about the lawyer personally. It's also, interestingly, about experts the lawyer hires. So if you take a look at source number 8, Smith v. Jones, an important case that we'll refer to off and on, they quote a case from Quebec. The Quebec Court of Appeal concluded, when counsel requires the services of an expert in order to help him better prepare his defense, he acts within the scope of his mandate. It is the interest of his client which compels counsel to confer on a specialist the charge of evaluating the case. And it follows that the accused must be able to undergo the evaluation in the same climate of confidence and in complete confidentiality as if he were communicating with counsel. And that's the quote from the Quebec case. And then the court concludes, this reasoning is persuasive and confirms that conversations with defense experts, such as psychiatrists, fall within the solicitor-client privilege and attract permanent and substantive privilege, and they give you some references. This case in particular that they're talking about was where a psychiatrist had been called in to evaluate evaluate the client, and the psychiatrist's opinion was that the client was actually dangerous. And then the psychiatrist felt it was important to disclose it to the potential victims of the client, and the question was, can the psychiatrist disclose it or not? And leave aside the conclusion, because that's its own discussion, but the point that's made here is that technically the expert is also under this. Now here I need to make a key distinction, because we used a word here in source number 8 which is different from confidentiality. We use the term privilege. What's the difference between confidentiality and privilege? Sorry?
Communications between the client and the lawyer.
Right.
Is privileged, whereas confidentiality could be information from any source, right?
Right. Confidentiality could be information from any source. Privilege will apply specifically to the communications that they've had. This is true. Yeah. Right. Privilege is fundamentally a right of the client in terms of information to be presented in court. It's a very narrow term. Confidentiality is this much more broad obligation. So both points that were made are true. Privilege is about the communications between the lawyer and the client, and privilege is specifically, really, a rule for, within the court, what can be demanded, what information can be demanded, and what the client is able to say, I don't want to have disclosed. Take a look at source number 9, please. Confidentiality versus privilege. Though the term privilege is often used to refer to a lawyer's duty of confidentiality, the duty of confidentiality, underneath my staple here, must be distinguished from solicitor-client privilege. Privilege is an evidentiary rule of law that refers to the legal right of an individual to withhold information from an opposing party, a court, a tribunal, and investigations, including law enforcement officials. Most fundamentally, for the purpose of our discussion, privilege is the client's decision. As opposed, even if the lawyer has to be sensitive to it and say, you know, you have the right to invoke it, but it's fundamentally about the client's decision. Confidentiality is what the lawyer has to make the call on. Confidentiality is a broader ethical issue. Privilege is more technical. Confidentiality is the lawyer's burden. Privilege is the client's option. So what I want to deal with is the lawyer's personal decision of whether to reveal information in order to save somebody else from harm, or in order to do what, well, we'll see, the three vignettes that we're talking about. But we're going to be focusing on confidentiality rather than privilege. So, from a law society perspective, there's a very clear responsibility, separate from society's value of confidentiality and separate from Section 8 and all the other things we mentioned about confidentiality, there is an expectation that lawyers will keep the information of clients confidential. Clear? That's what the obligation is for the lawyer. What about within Judaism? What about a Jewish view of a lawyer? Is there anything specific to the practice of law as opposed to the overall values like rechilut, about not tail-bearing, that we talked about before? So it's going to be hard to find this for the practice of law within Judaism, because we classically didn't have lawyers as an official position in a court of law. They existed, but it wasn't an official formal position, meaning when we had the session a while back on self-representation at Shari Shemayim and the issue of facing a self-represented litigant, so we said at the time that there was historically the possibility of somebody assigning his case to somebody else who would then actually represent them in a Beit Din, in a rabbinical court. We had someone who was called a Murshe, somebody who would be licensed by the client to go in and act on his behalf. The term that's used today for a lawyer is Orech Din. So that exists in the time of the Mishnah, right? Going back 2,000 years, they say to the judge, you should not act as as Orchei HaDayanin, don't act like the lawyer for one of the litigants. Right? There are, so that means you have such a concept. Somebody's going to help the litigant to arrange and present the case. There were those who did this, but there's no formal position in a court of law, in a Beit Din, I should say, in a rabbinical court of law, of lawyers. So how could you actually demand confidentiality of somebody who doesn't exist? Yeah?
So it's a question of expectations. If I speak to my friend and he tells me about his business, and I'm, let's say, in a similar business, I'm not necessarily bound to not compete with him in that business. He's telling me something and I'm free. But if I'm a lawyer, if I have a relationship that where the person telling me something has a higher level of expectation, then that should be a function of the ethics built in within the morality, how you interpret someone's expectations.
Right. So I think you have. I think you're correct. Bill is right that there is an issue of personal expectations. Although in this case, the personal expectations are actually set by what exists in the law society's rules. Why does he have that expectation that I, as his lawyer, I'm not going to act on this information? Because he knows that I, as a lawyer, am bound by the rules that are set up within society. It's not because of anything within Judaism, although Judaism will bind me to honor those expectations that he has. From that perspective, it's correct. There is one possible avenue that I think you could argue within Judaism itself for a special duty of confidentiality here. Well, you could make another argument also that if it's going to damage my ability to handle the case, then also, because as a professional I'm hired to do a job and I can't do the job as well if I disclose the information, you could make that argument also, I suppose. But one element that I find very interesting is a point made by Rabbi Alfred Cohn. Rabbi Alfred Cohn wrote an article in 1981 or 84, I forget, I think it's 81, in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, in which he presented the following argument. The Talmud talks about the issue of redeeming captives. What happens if somebody is taken captive and is going to be either sold as a slave somewhere or redeemed by the Jewish community? This was a historical reality for Jews and their communities at various times over the millennia, but we're dealing specifically Roman era right now. There was an active slave trade. There would be people who would kidnap Jews from their communities, and they would say, look, you have a choice. Either we are going to sell them as slaves somewhere, or if you like, you can ransom them. And the question is, we have a major value of pidyon shvuyim, of redeeming captives. Does this now obligate us to pay whatever they demand in order to ransom the captives? What's the concern?
They'll go get more
captives. You give them an incentive. Business is good, right? They know. Kidnap a Jew, go to the local Jews, they'll raise the money, and now you can eat dinner. So what do we do faced with this problem that the more you pay, the greater the incentive you provide? So the Talmud states, and I brought it from Maimonides just as a simpler formulation in source number 10. He wrote, we do not redeem captives for more than their value. Their value means what they would be sold for on the slave market. For society's sake, lest the enemy pursue them to capture them, because otherwise you're just giving them an incentive to kidnap more people, to hold people for higher ransoms, and so on. So what you're seeing here, and this is the point that Rabbi Alfred Cohn makes, is that we're willing to have a situation in which somebody, an individual, is going to suffer for the sake of the community. If the going rate, making up numbers, if the going rate for this person on the slave market would have been $10,000 and they demand $15,000, the community says, forget it. We're not going to pay. This fellow's going to end up being sold as a slave. Why? Because of the need of the community. Now, there's a cap on that. Tosma, commenting in the Talmud, writes that this is only where it's not a life and death situation, where the alternatives are either you ransom him or he's going to be sold as a slave. He's going to be miserable, but he's going to live. In the event that the choice is ransom him or he dies, then we're expected to raise the money. So there is a cap on how far we're willing to go to prioritize society over the individual. But the point that Rabbi Cohn makes to draw this parallel is that society relies on having a system of justice in which clients can speak openly with their lawyers, and that overrides, that concern overrides the harm done by keeping the information confidential. So he suggests that just as regarding ransoming, we're saying put the needs of society over the needs of the individual, so too when it comes to confidential information, protect society by having the system of representation which is confidential, even if it means that the person who would have benefited from learning that confidential information is out of luck. You follow the analogy? A little complex. Hopefully not too much for an early Sunday morning. But that's the analogy that he draws. And maybe from that point, even though, again, you won't find anything on the books in a Jewish work of law saying lawyers have to keep confidentiality separate from the general social responsibility, nonetheless, from a philosophical standpoint, you find the idea. Yes?
Is that analogy argued in reverse? Maybe for the benefit of society disclosing information, that might outweigh the benefit of...
Correct.
Making that one individual's information confidential, so it's really arguable.
Correct. Although it will become society versus society at that stage. But we do have one of the exceptions for public harm. And that tells you that, yes, this is in fact the live calculation. At what point do the scales balance in the other direction? So we're going to have to revisit that. And that's actually what we're up to now. So that's very convenient. The exceptions to confidentiality. We have established the general value of confidentiality within society, both from a Canadian perspective and a Jewish perspective. And we've established as well within law that there is a special duty of confidentiality for the lawyer to protect the system. Within Judaism, that is less established in terms of, well, it's not established in terms of the lawyer. However, philosophically, it does resonate this idea. Idea of valuing the needs of society over the needs of the individual who would have benefited from that information, recognizing that there will be exceptions to this rule. So far, so good?
Is that akin to disclose that there's a serial rapist in the area, a serial murderer, because society has to know to be on guard?
Yes.
Society needs to know.
So that's where we're going with the discussion of the exceptions. That's exactly where we're going, and there are some nuances in the case you just gave that we're going to have to address. So yes. So take a look at your sheet, please, at number 11. Number 11 is an extension of what you saw in number 7. 7 was the rule that said a lawyer has to hold everything in strict confidence. Number 11 picks up from there and gives us the exceptions. Shall not divulge any such information unless... Are there any extra sheets still, or are the sheets all taken? Oh, there is one still, Alex, if you want it. Shall not divulge any such information unless... A, expressly or impliedly authorized by the client. I don't think I've seen the word impliedly anywhere other than the Law Society. I don't know if that is a word, isn't a word. But expressly, I thought it was implicitly. I don't know why it's impliedly. Fine. Expressly or impliedly authorized by the client. So if the client says, go tell... Right? That's the equivalent of what we saw in the Talmud back in source number 4. God says to Moses, go tell. Okay, so go tell. So if the client, not to the client is God, to the lawyer, nonetheless, if the client says go tell, fine. B, required by law or by order of a tribunal of competent jurisdiction to do so. Okay, if the lawyer is required by a tribunal which recognizes what the confidentiality issues are and says, nonetheless, you have to disclose, then at that point the lawyer will be obligated to disclose that information. I want to pause on that one for a moment. In terms of being required to disclose by the tribunal, take a look at source number 12. Because number 12 clarifies this to a certain extent. Although the rules make it clear that the lawyer shall not knowingly assist or encourage any dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct, and provide a rule for how a lawyer should respond to conduct by an organization that was, is, or may be dishonest, fraudulent, criminal, or illegal, the emphasis is mine in the next part, it does not follow that the lawyer should disclose to the appropriate authorities an employer's or client's proposed misconduct. Rather, the general rule as set out above is that the lawyer shall hold the client's information in strict confidence, and this general rule is subject to only a few exceptions. Meaning, if you know your client is going to commit a crime, that does not mean that you go to the police. We will talk about where you do go to the police. We'll get to that. But just the fact that the client is going to engage in criminal behavior does not mean you have grounds for disclosure. It may mean you have to step away from representing the client. But it does not mean that you necessarily go to the authorities. Yeah?
Going back to 11, authorized by the client.
Yes.
I don't think that the estate trustee stands in the same shoes as the deceased. So that it may be that you may not even know the estate trustee tells you to disclose it. You still may not want to disclose it without a court order.
Right. Good. That's a very important point. When you're dealing with estate law, the question is, who is the client? Right? Is the client the deceased, or is the client the trustee, and who has the authority to authorize that? I am not expert in that at all. I don't know if anyone wants to weigh in on that, but it's certainly an interesting question: is who is the one who actually has the right to authorize that disclosure?
I don't think that the estate trustee has carte blanche to stand in the shoes of the deceased.
Michael.
I just want to ask about that question. Is the question really, what does the person's, the client's right to confidentiality continue after death? Is that
Absolutely.
The issue you're getting at?
Absolutely. But the question is whether the estate trustee picks up all the marbles of the client.
Right. Interesting. Yes.
Well, I'm a lawyer for Jewish Family and Child Services. Sometimes we have counseling records historically, people who are, you know, are deceased and then are subject to estate litigation issues. And we have been approached by estate trustees to try and get counseling records. So we tend to tell them that we're not going to release anything without a court order.
Sure.
For that reason, because it is a bit ambiguous.
Interesting.
And violate even the deceased in some way.
Okay. Got it. Thank you. Yes.
Go to jail, but does he have to go to jail?
Good. Okay, so that's a very important distinction to be made. Here, the distinction that we're talking about is the distinction between a requirement to tell or an option of telling. So right now, we're talking about required by law or by order. That is actually a must. In that situation, one will be obligated to tell. We're about to see a case which is a may, in which you're allowed to but not required to, but in the case where the tribunal says you have to tell, then the lawyer indeed is going to be required to tell. But that brings me to the second one, the second exception that we need to discuss. The second exception is the one that is for the sake of avoiding harm, and that's number 13. Rule 3.3-3. A lawyer may disclose confidential information, but must not disclose more information than is required when the lawyer believes on reasonable grounds that there is an imminent risk of death or serious bodily harm, and disclosure is necessary to prevent the death or harm. Okay? A lawyer may disclose, that's the key word, not must, but may, but must not disclose more information than is required, we're going to have to come back to that point, when the lawyer believes on reasonable grounds that there is an imminent risk of death or serious bodily harm, and disclosure is necessary to prevent the death or harm. In the commentary, the Supreme Court of Canada has considered the meaning of the word serious bodily harm in certain contexts, which may inform a lawyer in assessing whether disclosure of confidential information is warranted. In Smith v. Jones, which we're about to quote, the court observed that serious psychological harm may constitute serious bodily harm if it substantially interferes with the health or well-being of the individual. This is a classic question. I get this question a lot on this point. But yes, psychological harm may well be included in serious bodily harm. So, yes?
11B.
Yeah.
Competent jurisdiction, basic tribunal, has not the same power, does not have any court. They do not have the power of the court in any way or form. I can understand if this judge orders someone, a lawyer, to release information, I can understand it. A tribunal has no authority whatsoever to order any lawyer, any information. They don't have the power.
So we have two possibilities here, right? Well, three possibilities. One possibility is that the law society is wrong. I suppose. I'm going to not go with that, with option A. Possibility number two is that the definition of tribunal that they're working with is different from yours. Or possibility C is that no, tribunals actually can. those are your three options. And again, knocking out the first one, because I'm pretty sure it's not true. Because this has been on the books in various iterations of the rules of professional conduct as far back as I've been able to find. So I think the answer is either you're working with a different definition of tribunal than they are, or they can. Yeah. Correct, and that's why they emphasize here on reasonable grounds, right? In from a Jewish perspective, we have a principle: safek pikuach nefesh is pikuach nefesh. If I am not sure whether the action is necessary to save a life, I treat it as though it is necessary to save a life. But take a look at source number 14, because I brought you relevant paragraphs from Smith v. Jones on this point of the of defining some of our key terms in this. So, paragraph 79 from the decision. What should be considered in determining if there is a clear risk to an identifiable group or person? It will be, and the key, an identifiable did not show up in what we saw at number 13, but that tends to be emphasized, that it be to an identifiable group or person for reasons we're going to talk about. But it will be appropriate and relevant to consider the answers a particular case may provide to the following questions. So ask these questions in assessing it. Is there evidence of long-range planning? Has a method for effecting the specific attack been suggested? Is there a prior history of violence or threats of violence? Are the prior assaults or threats of violence similar to that which was planned? If there is a history of violence, has the violence increased in severity? Is the violence directed to an identifiable person or group of persons? Again, we have to come back to the identifiable issue. This is not an all-encompassing list. It is important to note, however, that as a general rule, a group or person must be ascertainable. The requisite specificity of that identification will vary depending on the other factors discussed here. In other words, how specific does the target have to be depends on the other elements of the danger that we are talking about. So we've talked about a little bit in terms of the issue of requiring that it be an identifiable group and that you have a sense of how serious the risk is. But take a look at the next paragraph. Where you have those characters in the beginning, my font did something strange. It's paragraph 82. I don't know why that looks the way it does. The seriousness factor requires that the threat be such that the intended victim is in danger of being killed or of suffering serious bodily harm. Many persons involved in criminal justice proceedings will have committed prior crimes or may be planning to commit crimes in the future. The disclosure of planned future crimes without an element of violence would be an insufficient reason to set aside solicitor-client privilege because of fears for public safety. Again, it's worded in terms of privilege because that was the case in Smith v. Jones, but it will apply to confidentiality as well. For the public safety interest to be of sufficient importance to displace solicitor-client privilege, the threat must be to occasion serious bodily harm or death. The higher the harm that we're talking about, the more serious the harm, the less I will require certainty regarding an identifiable group or person. The higher you go on one, the lower you go on the others in terms of what we require. Take a look at 84, paragraph 84 on the next page. They talk about the issue of imminence. The risk of serious bodily harm or death must be imminent if solicitor-client communications are to be disclosed. That is, the risk itself must be serious. A serious risk of serious bodily harm, not a low chance. The nature of the threat must be such that it creates a sense of urgency. This sense of urgency may be applicable to some time in the future. Depending on the seriousness and clarity of the threat, it will not always be necessary to impose a particular time limit on the risk. Right? Meaning, if someone says, well, this isn't imminent because he's going to be in jail for the next 5 years, but he's saying the day after I get out of jail, there is a certain person and I'm going to hunt them down and use the weapons I have stored in such and such a place, right? I don't care that it's 5 years from now. That's the point they're making here. Depending on the seriousness and clarity of the threat, it will not always be necessary to impose a particular time limit on the risk. It is sufficient if there is a clear and imminent threat of serious bodily harm to an identifiable group, and if this threat is made in such a manner that a sense of urgency is created. A statement made in a fleeting fit of anger will usually be insufficient to disturb the solicitor-client privilege. On the other hand, imminence as a factor may be satisfied if a person makes a clear threat to kill someone that he vows to carry out 3 years hence when he is released from prison. If that threat is made with such chilling intensity and graphic detail that a reasonable bystander would be convinced that the killing would be carried out, the threat could be considered to be imminent. Imminence, like the other two criteria, must be defined in the context of each situation. So what we're saying is that the standard the Law Society is setting is really based on this ruling. This case gets quoted everywhere. On where you would violate privilege, and again, it will apply for confidentiality as well. And what we require is some certainty of a specific threat involving serious bodily harm or death. You have to have that sense that this is going to happen, that this is for real. Now, here's an interesting question for you. Why is it may instead of must? Why is it that you may disclose this? You know, you have a client. The client has said, in 5 years' time, on such and such a date, I am going to go use the weapons I have in such and such a place, and I am going to shoot them. Why is this only may disclose as opposed to must disclose?
I think the Law Society wants you to think about
to protect the lawyer from liability. If you say must, the lawyer now faces an obligation. This is true. Yeah.
I'm not sure the Law Society has jurisdiction to say must. You know, this is already getting into public safety. I'm wondering, you know, if they're perhaps leaving it for other law. I mean, it may be well be that if you don't, maybe you have an obligation to disclose, but it's not. That's not the Law Society's law. That's a different law. That might be common law.
So why is it they? Why do they say must when we talk about disclosing it to tribunal of competent jurisdiction?
That's a tautology. If the tribunal is of competent jurisdiction and it makes an order within its jurisdiction, then that's the same as required by law. It's really
right.
Just unpacking required.
Right.
By
so
law.
Why can't they just say may over there as well?
Because that's not a tautology. There's no law. I mean, they're not referring
no, but
to
if
a
there
law
is a,
that says
but if there is a law that but if there is a law that says I have to disclose, which is exactly where we're
yeah,
going with
if
this.
If there is a law, then they have to.
Then they should say must.
Well, so the Law Society doesn't have to say must. It's the other law that says must.
I'm going to come back to this because there's a key point that's important to note. Yeah. Because it's a judgment call, because there is uncertainty, so they don't want to create a duty for the lawyer that the lawyer may fail in just because they made the judgment call and they were wrong. So that's one possibility. I think there's another possibility. Yeah.
With respect to a court or tribunal of competent jurisdiction, the ruling there is respect for the law and the rule of law. So to say may in that context, it would be giving the lawyer a judgment call with respect to whether you're going to follow the law or what.
Interesting. So therefore you have to say must, as opposed to saving a life, where we'd rather not do that. Or we'd say, well, it's not... Yeah, sorry.
Under the rule of law.
Right.
Whether it's a judgment call of saving a life, do we know what this person got to avoid?
Right. Could be.
So, I still think it comes back to what you said.
Yeah.
Still, they want you to think about it, because must means if you didn't think, you're not left with the discretion to figure out whether or not that was actionable on your part. You have to think about it.
I hear you.
You may not have the time to make that decision. I had a situation where two survivors, they'd been in the forest or the camps together. One guy built the other guy of $20,000. And at 11:30 in the morning, I got a phone call. I don't think the lawyer's in this room. Who said to me, you know, I've never made a call like this before, but my guy's just left my office and he says he's going to kill your guy. And the bankruptcy meeting was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, typical Spadina Avenue situation. You just may not have it.
You may not have the time, so therefore it's a may. Maybe. I think there's a key element here, which goes back to what Michael had said, which is that in Ontario there's no duty to rescue. Meaning, unlike many other jurisdictions in Canada, and I think almost everywhere in the U.S., if I don't have a special relationship with somebody else, if I'm not their teacher, if I'm not a healthcare worker, whatever it is, then if I see somebody else in danger, I am not obligated to do anything. It's really as straightforward as that. And therefore, the Law Society isn't about to impose and say must towards somebody I don't have any duty to. Meaning, my client is not the one in danger. It's my client who's endangering somebody else. So, therefore, from that perspective, you're not going to obligate me. I have permission. And that's plenty. The truth is, you could ask the question the other way. If there's no duty to rescue, why am I even allowed to break confidentiality? You could ask the question the opposite direction, to which the answer may be, because you can't tie the hands of lawyers in a case like this. Just morally, you can't. But it's an interesting problem. Okay, I don't know who had their hand up first.
So, just moving into a slightly different area, the area of the discussion, that was dealt with in Tarasov, which was that case where there was an identifiable
right.
threat against somebody and she was killed. And the psychiatrist who did not disclose the suit. So you might have some liability later if you don't
right.
properly disclose a threat against an identifiable target. But how do you reconcile all of this with the duty to report under the law of child abuse?
Right. I think there society imposes a special responsibility of protection for children. I think that's why. It's
not discretionary.
Right.
So, and lawyers are on the mandated duty to report.
Right. No, that's correct. I should make that point. The if you're dealing with an issue of abuse against children, then all bets are off. Because the lawyer will have a mandate to actually report. There is. No, that's what I'm saying. Ontario, has implemented a duty to rescue in certain situations. There are the special relationship cases. There's the case of children. Right. I shouldn't say it blankly that there isn't, because you're right. There are cases where there is. Yes.
Obligations are, right? And it's not only the concerns of the law side, you're not only the relationship between the lawyer and the client, but also the reputation of lawyers and the perception of the administration of justice and the whole legal system. So I could just as easily see the law society saying, no, you must report, because if it comes out that the lawyer knew that someone was going to, some crazy guy was going to drive a van onto Young Street, and that lawyer didn't say anything, that's going to make everybody think lawyers are jerks, right? So the law society, I don't believe that they only say may, not must, because the law doesn't impose a must. I think that the points before about the ambiguity of the situation is a little more complicated.
So I hear what you're saying. But you could just as easily conjure up a case that goes the opposite direction, in which someone discloses something that is decided not to have been a risk, and then everybody says, how dare he have disclosed it? Lawyers aren't trustworthy. Right? It all depends on what actually happens in the end. But my point isn't to say that that's the sole foundation for why it says may, but I do believe it's a contributing factor in it. It's the law society saying, well, look, if we don't have, because in other jurisdictions it doesn't say may. It isn't true that all jurisdictions say may. There are a couple of ways in which Ontario has been unique, and this is one of them. One other note on this: we say that it's only for an identifiable person, right? A risk to an identifiable person. Why is that? There's no duty to anonymous people. You can make that argument.
Yeah, so the Young Street case, the lawyer knew he was going to write it down Young, but he didn't know the identifiable person, so he couldn't...
Right, so that's a really big question. That question has been asked. There was a case... No, what if he knew that? No, hang on. No, but what you just said was really important. If it had been known that it was women, there was a case in California in which a psychologist knew that there was a fellow who said he was going to attack women, or maybe it was a subset of women, I forget, in California. And the question was, is that sufficient now to try to give some kind of information to the police, even though there are millions of people within that group? Do you say that's considered an identifiable group or not? And a lot comes down to what was said in Smith v. Jones, which is the bar for identifiable goes down if imminence and seriousness of threat go up. the more likely that this is going to be acted upon, the less I care whether I know the name of the person against whom the action is going to take place. But this is an issue. There was a case in the U.S. There was a woman who had a tainted blood transfusion, and she was infected and she developed AIDS, and she then transmitted it to her boyfriend 5 years later. The boyfriend sued the hospital. They said, you should have disclosed that this woman, you know, was infected. And the response from the hospital is, we have no duty to an unidentifiable third party. How are we going to disclose it to all of her future boyfriends? What does that mean? How are we going to do it? So one view is that the reason why we require an identifiable victim is because it makes the practice of law impossible if you don't have an identifiable victim. Meaning, anytime you have a client who has given you information about wrongdoing on their part, or things that they're about to do, or things they might do in the future, you know, there are unidentifiable victims. That, you know, you're going to make confidential relationships impossible. But that's the basic idea, is that we require an identifiable victim, really, as part of ascertaining that this is a serious and specific threat. Yeah?
But the issue, one of the issues is, who do you tell? You know, the hospital there is arguing, we don't know who to tell. But the fact is, they could go to the police, they could go to the public officer, officer of public health. You know, there are other people to go to. I would argue that identifiable in this context is pretty much something that should be, that could almost be ignored, because I think you're right that the way that it's defined in Smith and Jones is such that once you've got imminence, once you've got a situation that's going to take place, you've got enough of identifiable. It's somebody who's going to be there. It's that person. We don't have to know their name.
Right. It's an interesting question. Let me throw in one more complication. What about where the client's risk is to the client? What about where the client tells the lawyer he's going to commit suicide? Now what? Not dealing with medical assistance in dying, and not talking about that. But the client says that he's going to commit suicide. So now, does the lawyer have the right to disclose? May disclose, to use the Ontario language. So take a look at source number 15. This is an article I found from a lawyer named Yossi Shochet. Only in Ontario, now I should say this, this article is 20 years old, and therefore what he says about only in Ontario is incorrect at this point. It was right when he wrote it, but it's incorrect now. He says, only in Ontario does this exception to confidentiality condone disclosure where serious preventable harm would flow from a non-criminal occurrence. Meaning, at the time that he wrote this, most law societies said that you disclose if you have information about a crime that would lead to serious risk of bodily harm and death and so on. But it only allowed for that in the case of a crime. And therefore you would say, since suicide was decriminalized decades ago in Canada, therefore you have no right to disclose. However, Ontario's wording then as now does not specify that it's in the case of a crime. And so therefore, he says, therefore, I would think that in Ontario, if there is an imminent risk to an identifiable person, in this case the client, of death or serious bodily harm, which includes suicide, the lawyer may disclose, pursuant to judicial order, where practicable, confidential information where it is necessary to do so in order to prevent the death or harm. And the operative word is may. So it's a very interesting question that's being asked there, and I think that and I think he's right in terms of the answer.
What if the client's a serial killer and he threatens suicide?
So you're saying what? Go ahead, you say it, not me.
There's a societal benefit for him to kill himself.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we don't go that route. I'm fairly sure we do not go that route. So even where disclosure is warranted, and then we're going to move over to the Jewish law side of this, but even where disclosure is warranted, we minimize the extent of the disclosure, right? That was already seen in 3.3 that we saw in the text of the rule. Not disclose more information than is required back in source number 13. You limit what you tell, and you also limit the people to whom you tell. You don't say it to everybody. If you take a look at source number 16, also from Smith v. Jones, you find a very interesting argument, which was defeated But it's the minority opinion there. This goes back to the case I mentioned before about the psychologist who knew, had been called in as an expert, had interviewed the client, felt that the client was indeed a risk. They was intending to attack people and kill them, and the psychiatrist wanted to disclose this information. And the question was, is the psychologist, is the psychologist able to disclose that information? So the minority opinion said not to disclose that information. Take a look at the argument. I think it's fascinating, even if it didn't win. If defense counsel cannot freely refer clients, particularly dangerous ones, to medical or other experts without running a serious risk of the privilege being set aside, their response will be not to refer clients until after trial, if at all. This could result in dangerous people remaining free on bail for long periods of time, undiagnosed and untreated, presenting a danger to society. The chilling effect of completely breaching the privilege would have the undesired effect of discouraging those individuals in need of treatment for serious and dangerous conditions from consulting professional help. I don't need to go through the rest of it. You already see what's being said here, right? In the event that the expert can disclose that information, the result is that the lawyer will not bring in the expert in the first place, and people who should be seen will not be seen lest that information be disclosed and damage their case. Bill.
Makes their blood redder than the rest
of society. Correct. Well, not necessarily. I'm sorry, that's not so.
Not necessarily, but it could be.
No, because the argument goes that it's really society versus society now. It's the society of their potential victims versus the society of people who need confidentiality.
Right. Why should the society of perpetrators have equal rights to the society of
victims? No, their argument is that there are victims either way now. Exactly. You have potential victims on either side. You have victims if they get seen, right? And the information is not disclosed, right? Because then the information isn't disclosed. You have victims if they don't get seen, and then they're free to do whatever they're going to do. You follow? You haven't necessarily saved their potential victims by having that information disclosed. Because the result is that this person is going to be caught, right? This person is going to be stopped because you disclosed it. But all the future ones are now going to not be seen, and therefore their victims. It's really a case of the victims of the person in front of us versus the victims of other people in the future.
Well, the way I put it with the criminal realm was cruel and unusually punished victims of repeat offenders. In this realm, you could try and make the argument of cruel and unusually punished victims of foreseeable mass murders, I suppose.
You're the identifiability issue.
Okay,
right. No, that's right, but it's true. No, that's right. That would be under the identifiability issue. So, what we've seen... Sorry.
It's an imminence issue.
Correct. To a certain extent, it's an imminence issue. That's correct. So, what we've seen then, within the practice of law in Ontario, is a must disclose when required by a tribunal, and a may disclose to prevent serious risk of serious bodily harm or death to a particular set of people. And again, the definitions of set of people and serious and so and imminent will be a little bit flexible. Within halacha, we also have the idea, within Jewish law, we have the same idea that you sometimes have to disclose for the sake of justice. If you take a look at source number 17, it deals with a person who has sworn an oath. Oaths are taken very seriously within Judaism. A person takes an oath saying to somebody else, I won't offer regarding you the testimony I possess. I have information about you. If the case comes up in court, they subpoena me, they ask me to testify, and that happens in a Jewish court of law, I will refuse to testify. Or I won't testify regarding you if I do know testimony. Not I know it, but if I do, I won't testify. Such a person receives punishment for a vain oath. He has taken an oath in vain. Why? Because Jewish law requires that those who know testimony testify. You're not free to take such an oath. He is bound by his commitment to the Torah in general that he will have to testify. So we have a concept of must disclose when required by a tribunal in that sense. When it comes to preventing harm to others, So here we get a difference, two key differences between what the Law Society requires and what Jewish law requires. Number one, there is an absolute requirement to disclose in order to prevent harm against others. It is not a may, it is a must. And this comes under two different biblical rules. The first one is the one that I mentioned in source number 18. V'lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol, do not place a stumbling block before the blind, which includes not giving somebody improper advice as recorded in the Midrash that I brought in source number 18. But as noted by Rabbi Yaakov Breish, the Chelkas Yaakov, it applies even in a case of inaction. Failure to act when I know somebody else is going to stumble is also a violation of biblical law. So in other words, the literal case of the blind. I see somebody walking along the street and he doesn't see the stumbling block. I am obligated to inform him that there's a stumbling block there. But it's not only about the blind, and it's not only about somebody stumbling as he's walking. It's any case in which my failure to speak up will result in that person suffering harm. So there is a requirement. That's number one. Number two, there's an obligation to intervene to save people from harm. Take a look at source number 19. How do we know that one who sees another person drowning in a river, being dragged by a beast, being beset by bandits, how do you know that you have an obligation to save that person? The Torah says, you shall not stand by the blood of your peer, lo sa'amod al dam re'echa. That was the verse that I quoted way back in source number 3, the second part of the verse. There I translated it slightly differently, because I did the translations at different times, but it's the same translation fundamentally. Do not stand by as somebody else's blood is shed. So because of this, there is a duty to interfere and to intervene in order to save others who face harm. Now, we're going to come back to a second difference between the Law Society standard and that of Jewish law, which is no one here has specified serious risk of death or bodily harm. Right? We haven't exactly specified what is included in danger, so we're going to come back to that.
But this
Jerry.
Is the duty to rescue that you're talking about.
Yes, this is exactly the duty to rescue.
Use that word now,
right. That's exactly right. This is indeed the duty to rescue, and it is imposed as serious biblical law. And this comes up in cases all the time. It comes up in cases of people who want to get a driver's license. If you flip the page, I believe I brought it in source number 20. Yes, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, major authority in Jewish law in Israel in the 20th century, was asked the question about somebody who is epileptic and has a driver's license. And what is your duty in terms of informing people that this person could have a seizure behind the wheel? And he said, of course you have to inform. It is of the greatest certainty one is permitted and also obligated to inform the authorities of this person's illness. And it goes on. It applies in many, many cases. A doctor asks the question of a... he sees I don't remember if it's a husband or a wife. He sees somebody who is HIV positive. And his question is, do I tell that person's spouse? And the answer is, he's obligated to tell the person's spouse. That's the way it works. Raquel, you had your hand up? Okay. Yeah, Jeffrey. So that's a great discussion, but I'm not going to go into it right now in the interests of time. But this has been a very real issue for rabbis in terms of confidentiality, because it spills into another realm. Not only the realm of physical harm, but the realm of spiritual harm. There was a case in New York, goes back about 15, 20 years at this point, in which a woman had stopped going to mikvah. Under the practices of Jewish law, a woman goes to a mikvah after experiencing her period. So until she has gone to the mikvah, the husband and the wife are prohibited from intercourse with each other. So she had stopped going to the mikvah. She had disclosed that information to the rabbi. The rabbi knows, the husband does not. And so the question is, does he let the husband know? Or does he allow the husband to proceed in ignorance? So that's one case in which this comes up. Another case in which this comes up, this is a classic case with a lot of response literature on it. It goes back a couple of hundred years ago to a case in which there was a woman who, again, disclosed, actually no, it was the man. It's a long story, but basically a married woman had an affair with a man, and the man had gone to the rabbi feeling terrible about what he had done. And now the rabbi knows about this affair that took place, and there was a question of the wife who had been involved in the affair about whether she could continue to remain married to her husband. And so the question is, does the rabbi speak up or not speak up? And there's a lot of response literature, again, on this issue. So you're asking a very important question, but to actually go into this in depth is beyond the scope of what we're going to be able to do right now. I will tell you, the RCA, unfortunately, does not have a manual on this. You're on your own. Here's your clock. Okay, Shalom Bayis is a big value, but I'm gonna go further because I see we passed the 1 hour mark and we have to now get to our cases. The only thing I will note here is number 21 is a very important point. Just like we said for the Law Society, one who is going to tell must make sure to limit what that person says. So take a look at source number 21 for Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, also known as the Chafetz Chaim. And he speaks about a case in which one feels a requirement to disclose for the benefit of others. He says, the person who is speaking, must intend to help, and not to benefit, God forbid, from that flaw he ascribes to the other, and not out of pre-existing enmity. Right? If the person you're talking about is your enemy also, you should probably find somebody to consult regarding going ahead and disclosing this information. It could be that there's a personal issue here. If you stand to gain personally from disclosing that information, again, maybe this isn't your judgment call to make. If he can cause that benefit in some other way, without needing to speak harmfully of it, then this speech is always prohibited. You can't disclose something if there's another way to achieve the same end. Raquel. Coming soon in vignette number 3. So we will see it. Okay. But you are 100% right. There's a need to weigh both sides against each other here in terms of the benefits. So we've established that there's a general social obligation of privacy in Canada. We've established that within Judaism as well. We've seen the imperatives from the Law Society's perspective. We've seen the imperatives from Jewish law's perspective for lawyers as well, in the sense of perhaps your professional obligation to somebody you have an agreement with, or in terms of the need to put society's needs before the needs of the individual who could be harmed. And we've talked about exceptions to the rule. Either we're required by law, by a tribunal, or the exception to the rule where you fear somebody faces serious bodily harm or death. So now let's get to our first case. The case is the following. As counsel for a public corporation, I become aware they are moving rapidly toward filing for bankruptcy. A neighbor of mine has invested her retirement funds in corporate stock. She's going to lose her retirement funds. May I inform her of the danger? Losing retirement funds, on the one hand, could be viewed as financial, purely financial. On the other hand, it's the most extreme financial, right? She may not be able to afford food, rent, right? So here's the question. She's making a bad investment decision. You know it. Are you allowed to disclose?
Absolutely not.
We get an absolutely not.
What do you do if that public company has a U.S. investor and he sues you and your assets are gone?
I'm glad you asked that question. The question was, what if there's a U.S. investor who can sue you for everything you have? And the answer is that actually the American rules are much more lenient on telling in this case because they include financial harm in this. The American rules changed at the time of Enron and various cases of fraud to actually loosen confidentiality in this regard in the wake of the avalanche of corporate impropriety. I am not saying... I see Alan's head. I see you shaking your head. I'm not saying that in this case in particular it will be a good idea to tell, but I'm saying that you should know that there is a financial exception that exists on the books in the U.S. that does not exist in Canada. Alan.
You've got to distinguish.
Yes.
Insider trading and tipping.
Yes.
Which is what you're talking about. It changes post-Enron, where if you're within the company,
right,
and the people in the company aren't telling the board or people beyond that of something, then they have a duty to disclose to make sure within the company or beyond that. But if you're counsel, or I mean, it's simple as that. The company doesn't have to be going bankrupt. If you know that they're about to be sued and it's going to wipe out the value, if you say anything, you're guilty of tipping.
Yes.
And anybody you tell gets tainted, and they can be prosecuted the same way.
Got it. Everyone heard that? So, yes, I'm not at all saying that. I just grabbed onto the U.S. thing and the fact that the rules are different there and they allow for the financial thing. Yeah, Gwendolyn, you were going
to
say?
I think the only solution on this example is to talk to your neighbor about the lack of judgment of putting all her eggs in one basket.
So you find some other way to recommend financial diversification. I tend to agree. But if you take a look at source number 22, I found this very interesting. Back in 2000, there was an attempt to actually change the rules to include financial harm. The proposed rule was, where a lawyer has reasonable grounds for believing there is imminent risk that a fraud, this wasn't a case of fraud, we're talking about bankruptcy in our case, but just know it, that a fraud that may cause substantial financial injury to another is likely to be committed, the lawyer may disclose confidential information to prevent the fraud, but shall not disclose more information than is required. But again, you see that there was an attempt to actually put financial harm, where it's a case of fraud, into it, and it was defeated. So something to keep in mind. But we generally say within the Law Society's rules, no, you do not disclose, unless the lawyer himself is being used for the fraud, where we talk about the lawyer stepping away. That's a separate discussion. And the reason why this isn't recognized as a form of harm like death, like bodily injury, is generally attributed to the fact that, number one, it would irreparably harm solicitor-client relationships. How in the world are you going to practice law if everybody you represent, if they are now, if their company is financially weak, you're going to run around telling people, right? That's one problem. And then the other problem that you run into is, or not really a problem, but the other reality is, this is a recognized cost of doing business. Investors don't expect to have this kind of information disclosed to them by the lawyers of the company. There's no expectation that someone is going to tell me about this. And that's another key element here. Phil?
I think financial harm is rather psychological harm. That door has already been opened. And it's a question of degree. I mean, if you're bilking, if you have Ponzi schemes, if you're taking away people's life earnings, you can cause a lot of psychological harm.
So, I don't think that still... I agree with you on fact. I don't think that fits into the justification here. I would recommend if someone had a case like this that they consult with someone at the Law Society to see if they would say otherwise. But I don't think so. It doesn't seem like it. Yeah, Jerry.
No duty to rescue. That's
what it comes down to. So the question is, what about within Jewish law? What will Jewish law say? So in fact, it's subject to a debate about how I read Maimonides. You see, if you go back to the case that we had, which I brought in, source number 19, where my obligation to intervene is given specific cases, right? I see someone drowning in a river. I see someone being dragged by a beast, being beset by bandits. So the question is, in these cases where I'm required to intervene, does that apply to physical harm, or does it apply even to financial harm? Being beset by bandits sounds like it's a financial harm case, and yet I have a duty to rescue. So if you take a look at source 24, you find Maimonides. 23 just included a couple of links with articles on why it is that there is no duty to, not duty to rescue, but why it is that there's no exception to confidentiality for fraud cases. But take a look at number 24. Maimonides writes, the 297th command, this is the one of saving people from harm, warns us not to be weak in saving a Jew when we see he is in danger of death or loss, and we are capable of rescue. So he specifies loss. I should note, just because you see the word there, I mentioned two reasons for breaking confidentiality. One, protect people from a stumbling block, and two, do not stand by as someone else's blood is shed. So, because he mentioned it here, the latter one is Jewish specific. It's about how you have to intervene for family, but the former one, lifnei iver, not to allow somebody to stumble, is for any human being. Jew, non-Jew, doesn't make a difference. So just because he mentions that there, I wanted to make sure to clarify that. But there's a debate as to how to read this comment of Maimonides, whether it's meant to include financial loss or not. It's not clear. One school of thought, the Meshech Chachma, Meir Simcha Cohen of Divinsk, believed that what you see in source number 24 in Maimonides is actually a copyist's error. He believes there is no obligation to intervene to save somebody from financial harm. He thinks a copyist made a mistake. Because Maimonides elsewhere does in fact seem to say that it's only physical harm. On the other hand, another major work of recent vintage, the Minchas Chinuch, disagrees, and he says, no, it applies to financial harm as well. And the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, took that position as well, that the obligation to save others from financial harm, to save others from harm, would apply in a case of financial harm as well. So you can make the argument either way within Jewish law. Now, that comes. Now, I'm running out of time, Reed. I'm running out of time, so I'm gonna hold questions and comments for till I get through the case. I do have to note another side, though, and this goes back to Raquel's comment before, which I'm really going to see more in number three, but it's relevant here as well. Here, Rabbi Alfred Cohn comes back with his point about harm to society. And he says the harm to society here in damaging confidentiality may well override the financial harm to the individual, especially when the case may be made that people invest in a company with the understanding that they may lose their funds. Buyer beware, this is what happens when you invest. And they understand that no special information is going to be given to them in violation of the rules. So that's a reason why we don't necessarily disclose. Further, what happens if you do disclose the information? Let's concoct the following scenario. You know your neighbor is about to invest in the firm, right? In the business. You know they're about to go bankrupt. You say to your neighbor, you tell your neighbor, don't invest there. The neighbor says, oh, I already invested. I'm going to sell my shares. Right? The neighbor now sells off her shares, sizable amount, it's her retirement savings, and then it comes to light, wait a minute, there was this big sale right before they declared bankruptcy. What is your neighbor going to have a problem with now? Insider trading. Right? They just sold off based on information that they received from the lawyer for the firm. Not only are you in trouble, but your neighbor's in trouble. You haven't necessarily made things better. You may have put a bigger stumbling block in the way of the neighbor. And then one last point on the side of not telling is the fact that you could well lose your law license by telling. And that's an important point. We have a general principle that says that if I have an ability to help someone, I'm obligated to do so. However, my life will come before the life of another person. I brought you the passage from the Talmud in source number 25, in which we are taught that yes, you have an obligation to help the needy among you, but your needs precede those of others. And therefore, if you're going to lose your license by telling them, it's nice that they have retirement savings, maybe they'll help you with their retirement savings, but you're not required to lose your license in that pursuit. There's more to say on that point. I'm going to come back to it in case number three. But therefore, what we're saying on this is the law society will say, don't tell. I understand the possibility that the financial harm leads to psychological harm, and I would say to consult the law society regarding that point. But I think as a general principle, we're going to say, don't tell. From a Jewish law perspective, there's a debate as to whether Maimonides believes that one should inform intervene in general to prevent financial loss, that there is a duty to rescue even from financial harm. But there are many arguments to be made that it will not apply in this case. Whether because you're harming society as well, like Rabbi Alfred Cohn notes, whether because people invest knowing that they could lose their funds, and that's the way it works. We often engage in business relationships in which we don't disclose pertinent information. That's the way it goes in adversarial relationships, for example. Because by telling others, I may set them up to do something illegal and get them and myself into trouble. And because fundamentally, you wouldn't be expected to lose your financial livelihood because in order to save somebody else's finances. Clear? Okay, just because we're getting down to the last 8 minutes, I'm going to go through case two and case three. I'm going to stick around to answer questions and discuss, but I want to make sure to get through the material we have here. Case number two comes from a case that actually was submitted to me by somebody within the group, and I thank them for the case. I am counsel. I altered it a little bit. I'm counsel in litigation on behalf of an individual who has disclosed to me that his suit is frivolous. So I'm ethically bound to withdraw from representation, which is true. I file a motion to withdraw. My client fights the motion. May I disclose to the court my reason for withdrawal? Right? Especially if you're going to withdraw, let's say it's a criminal case, and you're going to, not the frivolous lawsuit, it's a criminal case, and your need to withdraw is close to when it's actually coming to trial, so you're damaging the client's ability to have a defense. But you feel you cannot ethically represent the client. So now what do you do? So again, I would love to make it a discussion, but I won't. So if you take a look at source number 26 from R.V. Short, this is before the Ontario Court of Appeals. The case was where the lawyer wanted to withdraw. The judge thought that the lawyer only wanted to withdraw because of non-payment of fees. But actually, there were substantive reasons to withdraw. So trial counsel was candid in indicating that non-payment of his fees had created considerable strain in the relationship and made it impossible for him to properly prepare for the second trial. At the same time, however, trial counsel repeatedly told the court that the problems between he and the appellant had gone beyond those related to the non-payment of his fees and had reached the point where the client-solicitor relationship had broken down. As I understand Cunningham, which we'll see in a moment, the trial judge was obligated to accept trial counsel's representation. In other words, the judge should not have pushed. The judge should have accepted the motion to withdraw and taken the lawyer's word that, in fact, there's more here than non-payment of fees. That was what was supposed to happen. Take a look at number 27, which is the case of Cunningham that they're referring to. Assuming that the timing, meaning of the withdrawal and its impact, is an issue, the court is entitled to inquire further. Counsel may reveal that he or she seeks to withdraw for ethical reasons, non-payment of fees, or another specific reason, such as workload, if solicitor-client privilege is not engaged. Counsel seeking to withdraw for ethical reasons means that an issue has arisen in the solicitor-client relationship where it is now impossible for counsel to continue in good conscience to represent the accused. Counsel may cite ethical reasons as the reason for withdrawal if, for example, the accused is requesting that counsel act in violation of his or her professional obligations, or if the accused refuses to accept counsel's advice on an important trial issue. If the real reason for withdrawal is non-payment of legal fees, then counsel cannot represent to the court that he or she seeks to withdraw for, quote, ethical reasons. However, in either the case of ethical reasons or non-payment of fees, the court must accept counsel's answer at face value and not inquire further so as to avoid trenching on potential issues of solicitor-client privilege. In other words, the court has to say to the lawyer, we take you at your word. Now, I did see suggestions of using a sealing order or disclosing something in camera to the court. And if you take a look at number 28, A Litigator's Guide to the Challenging Lawyer-Client Relationship, you find the idea of writing out an affidavit, right, when one has to withdraw. The affidavit should also clarify the nature and extent and so on. Keep that on file and get a sealing order. The last line of number 28 was really why I had it there. Get a sealing order over the affidavit, but 29 is the key note here. 29 says the following from R.V. Short. Trial counsel's application to be removed from the record put the appellant in a difficult position, although he may well have been responsible for his own predicament. If possible, I think it would have been helpful had the appellant received some legal advice from duty counsel, or perhaps some senior member of the bar before the application proceeded. Counsel could have ensured that the appellant understood the nature of the application, his options in respect of representation, participation in the application, his right to maintain confidentiality, and the potential impact of the outcome of the application on the timing of and the appellant's representation at his upcoming trial. Tell the client what the issue is and what the impact is going to be, and get consultation on this before, you know, in terms of the decision to withdraw. But fundamentally, the judge is obligated to accept the lawyer's insistence that it's over an ethical matter. From a halachic perspective, from a Jewish law perspective, it seems fairly clear that since we're talking about harm to the lawyer, if the lawyer cannot disclose, again, your own benefit precedes the benefit of the other party, and therefore you would be able to disclose in as careful and limited a form as possible. Granted the concern potentially for harm to the legal system in the event that you disclose things and so on, you're not disclosing it, you're withdrawing. Is your withdrawal harming the system? In some sense, but I don't think it would match the concern. The last point. What would you do in the following case? As counsel in a case of medical malpractice, I become aware that a certain cardiac surgical team has a poor track record. A neighbor is planning on using them for her heart bypass surgery. I confer with my own counsel and learn this does not rise to the level of risk permitting disclosure. However, I do believe that I am obligated to warn her under the Jewish law requiring that I intervene to prevent harm to others. Do I inform her? You can come up with any case you want, but the idea basically is you believe that Jewish law requires you to disclose. However, the law society is not on the same page. So the secular law is obviously going to say, you know, follow the rules of professional conduct. Or maybe warn them about the general risks of surgery without saying anything about this group. From Jewish law, it is unclear to me what one would do at this point. I think it's not straightforward. As far as the confidentiality rights of the other parties, yeah, who are involved here, the people from whom you received this information, that's true, but you also have a duty to the person here who's in danger. We're talking about a case of physical harm. We're not dealing even with a case of financial harm. And really what it comes down to is weighing Rabbi Cohn's point about the protection of society against the need of a particular neighbor who is facing some level of risk. I think that both points are valid. I think that you can make the case either way in this regard. I don't think it's clear-cut one way or the other. So,
the first thing you do is ask the person you're representing, can you disclose it to somebody that you know?
Yeah, this is true. But the problem is that here, this is information gained in a case, gained being counsel in a case of medical malpractice. It's not asking the surgical team. You're asking somebody else. So the truth is, you could, Reed is correct, you could go back to the person you represented in the case of medical malpractice and say, it's no skin off your nose, so to speak, depending on what was done to them in the malpractice case. But it's no skin off their nose for me to use that information to protect somebody else. Maybe I could get their permission to disclose this, and that may be a solution.
Who's counsel?
I was counsel for a malpractice victim of the surgical team. So it could be that I can just get permission from my clients and be able to disclose it that way. But my emphasis is not really on the specifics of this case, right? This is a much bigger issue. What does the lawyer do when she feels that, on the one hand, halacha is telling me, Jewish law is telling me to tell, on the other hand, the law society is telling me don't tell. You can concoct whatever case you like. But that's the fundamental problem. The argument can be made that Jewish law does not expect you to lose your license in the service of fulfilling these commandments and helping the other party. That argument is a valid argument. You could make the argument that Rabbi Cohn makes, that the benefit of society is bigger. You can make that argument as well. But I think that this is the sort of question where you'd really have to consult with your rabbi as well as with your counsel in deciding what to do. I'm going to take one question and then I'll remain for questions afterwards.
Just wanted to clarify, are you representing
right, so that was what we had said. Right, that was what we had said. You represented the plaintiff. You're not representing the surgeons. Because it's information gained in the course of your professional. Hang on. Shh. Hold on a second. So you're saying that if I gain information in the course of serving as a lawyer for someone, but it's information that doesn't relate to them, then I'm okay. Yeah, you're right. That makes sense. So I'd have to construct the case differently, but you're correct. This case is flawed. Thank you. Thank you very much.